Starting at 9 with Alexis Madrigal. Let's find out about traffic at 8:59. Here again is Mel.
If starting in Richmond, 80 westbound from Hilltop Drive to Powell Street, still stop and go on the Bay Bridge. The backup, though, is only to the West Grand area on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. Traffic is still pretty much stopped back to Cutting Boulevard. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Visitors can currently explore Deborah Butterfield, P.S. These Are Not Horses, through June 30th, 2024. Sunny, warm to hot weather again today. Temperatures near the water in the 70s, up to 100 well inland. The Bay Area heat advisory continues for the inland areas, especially through tomorrow evening. Hot, very hot in the Sacramento Valley with highs 100 to 105. I'm Dave Freeman at 9 o'clock on KQED San Francisco and KQAI North Island, Sacramento.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Miriam Adelson is one of the richest women in the world, following her marriage to the late casino magnate Sheldon Adelson. Her political donations are astronomical, already reaching over $200 million to right-wing causes with the 2024 election coming up. So what does Miriam Adelson want? Asked writer Liz Weil in a New York Magazine feature. The answer is obvious. Support for a hardline policy in Israel from the Trump administration. We'll talk about what that might mean and how it would differ from present policy. That's all coming up next, right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
25. Status check. Go Atlas. Go Centaur. Go Starliner.
Apparently third time's the charm for Boeing and NASA. The commercially built capsule Starliner successfully fired off from Florida this morning. Sunita Sunny Williams and Barry Butch Wilmore, two test pilots in the space agency's commercial crew program and the first humans to fly in the Starliner, are expected to dock this hour at the International Space Station. Brendan Byrne of Central Florida Public Media is at the Kennedy Space Center.
NASA's Butch Wilmore and Sunny Williams launched atop ULA's Atlas V rocket on about a week-long mission to the space station and back. It comes after two launch attempts were scrubbed. Now that it has left the ground, the two astronauts are conducting a critical test flight of the Boeing-built Starliner capsule designed to transport astronauts to and from the station. This mission comes after years of delays of the program, including a software issue on the vehicle's first uncrewed flight in 2019 that prevented it from making it to the station. With this successful launch, it will take about a day to catch up with the station. The crew will spend about 8 days docked to the ISS before returning to Earth, touching down beneath a canopy of parachutes in the U.S. Southwest. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne at the Kennedy Space Center.
New restrictions are in effect on asylum seekers who try to enter the U.S. at the southern border. Yesterday, President Biden signed an executive order under which migrants seeking asylum are turned away if the volume of illegal crossings surpasses a daily threshold. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas spoke to NPR about the new action.
Well, it is our responsibility to deliver for the American people when Congress fails to do so. The executive action that the president has taken is no substitute for legislation, but we will do whatever we can within our legal authorities, and that is precisely what we have done.
Many Republicans still criticize Biden as weak on immigration policy. The Lebanese military says it has arrested a gunman who fired shots close to the U.S. Embassy near Beirut. NPR's Jana Raff has the latest.
The U.S. Embassy said there was small arms fire near its entrance this morning. It said embassy security and Lebanese forces responded quickly, and no embassy staff was hurt. The Lebanese military said security forces shot and wounded a gunman. It described him as a Syrian national. Lebanon has recently increased pressure on Syrians, saying it's overwhelmed with refugees. Embassy security in Lebanon has been particularly tight since the bombing of the U.S. mission in 1983, killed 63 people. The U.S. blamed that attack on Hezbollah, the Iran-backed Lebanese militant group. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
The U.S. Embassy in Lebanon says it is closed today but will reopen for business tomorrow. The Dow is up 62 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Updated sea level rise planning guidance adopted by California this week includes a positive development. The newest projections now push an extreme scenario that would see San Francisco Bay rise by more than 10 feet into the next century. KQED's Ezra David Romero explains.
The new guidance predicts just under a foot of sea level rise by 2050. Cities and counties will refer to it when building seawalls or levees, and for developments near the shore. Jen Eckerly is the Ocean Protection Council's executive director.
Lots of people live on the shoreline, so if we don't take steps to take action now, the cost of inaction will be much more in the future.
Eckerly says even a few inches of sea level rise could affect development in highways. Scientists predict that sea level rise and erosion could cause the loss of up to three-quarters of the state's beaches over the next century. I'm Ezra David Romero, KQED News.
Julie Hayner, who has been an anchor at KTVU for more than a quarter of a century, is retiring. Hayner announced her decision during Channel 2's 6 p.m. newscast on Tuesday. She says she wants to spend more time with her family. Hayner joined KTVU in 1997, covering some of the region's biggest stories. Her last day will be June 20th. In sports, the Giants lost again to the Diamondbacks 8-5. The A's lost to the Mariners 4-3 at the Coliseum. On the other side of Oakland, the B's lost their home opener to the YOLO High Wheelers. More of all three of those matchups today at lunchtime and tonight. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Morning support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And by the listeners and members of KQED. For the most part, sunny, temperatures near the water in the 70s to the low 100s well inland today. Then things change along the coast tonight. The National Weather Service says it becomes partly cloudy, areas of fog after midnight along the coast and bay, still clear inland overnight. Some cooler temperatures tomorrow.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In New York Magazine, writer Liz Weil has a new feature about one of the richest people in the world and the mega donor of mega donors in American politics, Miriam Adelson. The story is called Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business, and Liz joins us this morning to walk us through this investigation into Adelson's political influence. Welcome.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit, who is Miriam Adelson?
You know, she's really fascinating. Let's just start at the beginning. She was born in Palestine, what became Israel, in 1945. So right at the end of the war, in the most contentious, traumatized circumstances you can imagine. Her mother had come from Poland by herself in 1940. Her mother was 18 then. She left a 17-year-old sister behind because the sister hadn't finished high school. And pretty much her entire extended family was murdered by the Nazis, and everybody's family was like that. So Miriam grows up in a cohort that people refer to as children of the state. Israel is founded in 1948, and they grow up alongside this country. The country's at war from the start. And they have this burden placed on them to create this place and create a place that is safe for the Jewish people who have just been exterminated in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, she then goes on to do some pretty remarkable things. Like, this is not somebody who did not have her own distinguished life before she married Sheldon Adelson and became, you know, the wife of a multi-billionaire.
Yes, she married him in middle age. So she grew up in Haifa. She goes to sort of one of the best high schools in the country. She goes to medical school, and she's an ER doctor. And then while she's working in the ER, she becomes really interested in addiction, in the patients who keep coming back. And why do they keep coming back? And she becomes a specialist in addiction medicine. And it seems to me, in a way, you can see her as somebody who is trying to protect and save her people in a completely different way early in her life. So She comes to the United States in the 80s to do a fellowship at Rockefeller University in New York, working with one of the women who sort of helped create methadone treatment. Her life was like gritty and helping individuals one person at a time and doing research. It was like totally different. She had two girls and she'd gotten divorced from her first husband, who was a doctor. And then she meets Sheldon that she set up on a blind date. And his story is sort of interesting, too. He was also divorced. He had just gone to Israel for the first time in the late 80s. And he came back, and he grew up in Boston. He grew up like the son of a taxi driver and a mom who owned a knitting store. Like, he grew up poor. He didn't finish college. He starts coming into lots of money through entrepreneurship, and he goes to Israel, and he comes back, and he's in a Jewish deli in Brookline, and he runs into an acquaintance of his who had been Miriam's childhood best friend. And he tells her he wants to like meet a Israeli woman, that he's fallen in love with Israel and Israeli women. And does she know anybody in Jerusalem? And she says, no, but I know this really amazing doctor in New York. So she's in the middle of her life. She's 40. She's had this whole other life. And then they get married.
Their wealth then was tremendous, but it really began to grow with this casino business, the growth both in Las Vegas and then overseas. At this point, how much money is there? I mean, it's like $30 billion, I think.
Well, now she's worth about $30 billion. Mm. So yes, they sort of, they have a casino empire, the Sands. So they have casinos in Vegas. In the mid-2000s, they open a casino in Macau, for the Asian market. And that market just explodes. There was a period in the 2000s where they were making $1 million an hour. Jeez. So the money just sort of becomes endless.
Yeah.
And both Sheldon and Miriam have one priority. They were always very clear on that. The security of Israel was what they wanted to do with their money. And they were very good at using money to create political influence to shape the world they want.
Yeah. Their vision of the security of Israel. Yeah. So what distinguishes the way that they've given money from, say, other ultra-rich mega donors out there?
Well, there's some similarities and some differences, but they were very early to understand the power of Citizens United. So
the landmark Supreme Court case that essentially made it possible for anybody to donate unlimited sums of money to political candidates.
Yes. So that's in 2010. And they start giving basically more than anybody else.
An effective strategy in political donor circles, yeah.
Yes, and they understand how to use the money to get what they want. So like in 2005, they give combined $500,000 to Bush's inauguration. And it's sort of interesting. They see that this gets them proximity and access. It gets Miriam the ability to drop off what was a CD at the time about jihadists to like give to the president, and like she's respected and it is received. But they don't actually shape his foreign policy. That Bush holds peace talks, which they aren't interested in. So then with Trump, they start giving really a lot more money. They start giving tens of millions of dollars. They start giving endlessly to like the Republican Senate Leadership Caucus, the Republican Congressional, or these super PACs, and it gets you what you want.
Yeah. So you're covering a Jewish mega donor. I mean, how do you do this coverage without feeding into sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about, money coming from shadowy Jewish donors?
The short answer is I don't know. And the next short answer is very carefully. Like the contentiousness and even the debate within New York Magazine, the copy editor has incredibly strong opinions on the language, and the legal counsel has incredibly strong opinions on the language. And it takes, I think, something of a leap of faith, which is probably not earned, that people are going to actually read and consider what you are doing, and also understand that this is one individual who has mm-hmm. her own priorities and her own power, and she is not an entire people. And in fact, most of the Jewish people don't agree with her politics mm-hmm. whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult.
Well, you kind of have to, too, right? You have to cover it because, you know, just last week, right, it was announced that they're going to channel $100 million into the 2024 election.
Yes. So last week, so typically the Adelsons gave money late, like often in September of a presidential election year. But yes, right after Trump's conviction, she basically announces that she's going to give Trump $100 million.
Wow. And that $100 million, this is sort of the core concern of your story, which is, what does that mean? Like, what is that trying to influence? It's not just, you know, for fun that she's giving $100 million.
No, it is definitely not just for fun. So over the course of reporting the story, obviously, I talked to a lot of people and a lot of policy wonks. And the most concise explanation I heard to understand what she wants is that, like, they told us last time. So in Trump's last administration, he had, through Jared Kushner's, expertise, devised what he called the deal of the century. It was their Israel-Palestine peace plan. And some of that plan got enacted. I feel like peace, we also have to see in air quotes. This is not everybody's
version of peace.
You were air quoting,
in fact. Yeah.
So some of what Adelson wanted happened last time. For instance, like the United States Embassy in Israel got moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which might sound like not a big deal if you're not all immersed in this discourse, but it was actually a tremendously big deal. Also on the list of things in that program that did not get finished was basically the United States recognizing Israel annexing the West Bank. So that's like the most contentious thing that is like still on the agenda. So
because it's like beyond settlers and support for settlers, right? Which is already an American left.
Incredibly. Yes. So yes, I mean it's illegal under international law. We can just start there. So the Adelsons have already been giving and like starting like a medical school in the West Bank, you know, sort of creating very serious infrastructure. But the United States doesn't recognize the West Bank as part of Israel. And that is, you know, arguably what you could say. What Miriam wants in this next term is recognition, not just that there are settlers there, but that this is part of the country.
And are you seeing any signs the Trump administration plans to do that? Anything yet?
Well, you can see signs that he's paying a lot of attention to what she wants, and he hasn't done a perfect job. So they've had dinner a few times in recent months. You know, they are in conversation with one another, and this spring they had dinner. Shabbat dinner at Mar-a-Lago. And after this dinner, a few days later, Trump gives an interview to two reporters from the newspaper, the Israeli newspaper that the Adelsons own. And in this interview, he basically is saying out loud to her, I am the best friend Israel has ever had. Look at what we did last time together. Look at all these things that we achieved. But then he also says, basically, you got to finish this war. You got to get done. And that is not what she wanted to hear. And so she didn't announce a big donation to him right after that interview. It took her a little while. And I think it took maybe until she starts noticing the huge fundraising gap between Biden and Trump, or what was the huge fundraising gap, and maybe it's the conviction. I don't know. I'm not inside of her head. But right after the conviction, she announces a huge gift.
We're talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine, about her new story, Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business. Love to hear from you. There have been massive changes in political donations since Citizens United, the big Supreme Court case that Liz mentioned. What have you seen? How much of a voting issue is Israel and the war in Gaza for you? You can give us a call. Numbers 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Support for KQED comes from the Asian Art Museum. Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org. And Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise Software Platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations.
I'm Asma Khalid. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. It was the fruit of decades of work by conservative activists.
The anti-abortion movement was finding ways to amass power, either through conservative state houses, in the courts, and create this all but unstoppable machine.
The new book, The Fall of Roe, next time on Here and Now.
Coming up at 11 after Forum.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine, about her new article, Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business, about a massive mega donor to Republican causes. You know, there certainly, at least on the internet and among some people, is a sense that President Biden's Israel policy is in sort of total alignment with hardliners in Israel, and that there'd be, you know, that there's this kind of equivalence between what Biden is doing and what Trump might do. Based on this reporting, how do you think about that?
Well, I think Biden also has a lot of donors who have very strong opinions about Israel's security. That said, he has a much wider range of constituents on the issue of what should happen in the Middle East. And he is very clear that he believes in a two-state solution, that the road to peace is a two-state solution. Adelson doesn't believe that. She doesn't want that. And I don't think you'll hear Trump saying that.
What does she want then?
You know, this is a really good question to try to define in a positive sense what she wants. So if you start from what she wants is security, I think that there's a sense of fear of, like, how do we have a Palestinian state as our neighbors and feel secure? So as we all know, there's not like a very strong vision of like what happens after this war. But that is the priority, and it is sort of whatever it takes. Because I think if you grew up like her, believing that the security of the state of Israel was a matter of life and death, literally, like this, not an exaggeration, then I think your sense of what security means is really pretty different from somebody who sort of believes in diplomacy and believes that we can all live side by side with self-determination.
But I mean, we have the Kushner plan, right? So if we have the Kushner plan such as it is, what does that say about the future of Palestinians in Israel?
Inside of Israel?
Inside of Israel and also, you know, in what are now these occupied
territories. You know, these are huge questions, and frankly, they're a little bit above my pay grade. But I will say that Sheldon in particular was very clear that democracy in Israel was not the priority, and that if something's going to have to get sacrificed here, it's going to be the idea of one person, one vote, which is problematic if you want a certain kind of policy within Israel.
Let's bring in our first caller here. Let's bring in Andrew in San Francisco. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi there. Yeah, I was just kind of wondering, the terms that we're using are kind of fuzzy. I haven't heard anyone say that Miriam Adelson's funding, you know, what essentially is an apartheid government. You know, we say that she's born Palestinian into the settler colonial regime, but no one's saying that she's quite literally funding a two-state system that values Israelis and herself over the lives of Palestinians who are currently undergoing a genocide. And I'd like to hear someone say something about that.
You're absolutely correct. Like she is, heavily backing a regime that is an apartheid state, that is funding the extermination of Palestinians. I think that even just sort of calling what's going on there a war right now is not an obvious use of the word. So I'm really with you on that.
And what about to the kind of question of the actual money, like the size of this money and where it has gone so far? Like if we take $100 million, say the promised dollar amount for this coming election cycle, how does that stack up with other donors?
It's at the front of the pack. So where it goes in particular is to the Preserve America Super PAC. And if you go to the Preserve America website, you will not see anything about Trump. You will just see a picture of Joe Biden looking very old. Mm. And you will see messaging that Trump is going to destroy, not Trump, that Biden is going to destroy America. So it goes into this Super PAC. And from there, you know, goes into...
Yeah.
Election efforts.
And this has been kind of the strategy going back at least a few election cycles, like you were saying, to, you know, post Citizens United World. But where did she first kind of cut her teeth? Like at the beginning of this political influence career, she was kind of giving to both parties at least a little bit, right?
Right. So when Sheldon and Miriam get married, they're Democrats and they're giving to Democrats. And this is in 91. And then in the 90s, in the early 90s, basically they switched to the Republican Party for tax reasons. That, you know, the tax code, as the Republicans put it forth, is much better if you're ultra rich. And Sheldon in particular was pretty into union busting. There were all these like financial things about the Republican Party that spoke to them. And then they also realized that the Republican Party, they could help mold a candidate that they wanted. You know, they propped up Newt Gingrich's 2012 election campaign. You know, initially they weren't even Trump supporters. He was not the most pro-Israel candidate. And there's this tweet, I think it's from 2016, where he's making fun of other Republican primary contenders for how much they're pandering to Sheldon, of basically saying, you guys are just Sheldon's puppets. Like, this wasn't his policy. But as we all know, candidates need money. He will do a lot to get money to get elected.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because the Trump approach to this has always seemed kind of incomplete, or at least not ideological in any real sense. It seems like it's just been kind of in response to outside pressures. Does that make him maybe uniquely influenceable because there's maybe not a core value system in the center of it?
You know, that's a judgment call, but it seems that way to me. You know, so Ivanka Trump converted to Judaism. You know, like Jared Kushner is Orthodox. She converted even before they got married. There's sort of fascinating conversation between Miriam and Ivanka you can find online, in which she gets Ivanka to sort of talk about her conversion to Judaism. So it's a really complicated issue within the Trump family. And frankly, Israel policy is an incredibly contentious issue within the Jewish community. Like over the course of reporting this piece, I talked to the guy who runs J Street, which is a moderate Jewish lobbying group. And he was just tearing his hair out trying to explain that Israel policy has basically become like abortion policy or gun policy, and that money on the right has really parted public policy from public opinion. And, you know, as we've all been through a million times with gun control, like this is not what the majority of people want, but it's very, very difficult to get policy change because of how much money is involved.
Just to reemphasize what you said, that public opinion and public policy have parted ways, in part because there's a lot of right-wing donors on the issue.
Yes. So like we see it with reproductive rights, like it's and I think what was surprising to me, even having followed this stuff a little bit, was having someone say it's like the NRA, the Israel lobby is like the NRA. There is that level of money and there's that level of pushing a policy that doesn't have majority support.
The Adelsons have also really supported the development of this lobbying infrastructure as well. You know, if J Street is kind of in the moderate to left sort of side of things, and there's other organizations as well that they have thrown their allegiance to that are much further to the right.
Yes. So for a while, they were huge donors to AIPAC. I'm going to forget the exact letters behind all the acronym, but they're huge donors to AIPAC, which is a Israel.
American Israel Public Affairs Council?
Yes.
Committee.
Committee. Okay. Yeah, they wield a tremendous amount of power. But the Adelsons actually broke with AIPAC because AIPAC was basically supporting the peace process in ways that were just too centrist for them. And now they've heavily backed the IAC, the Israel American Committee something, which is further to
Council.
The right.
Yeah.
They also really backed the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America. So, yes, there are lots of groups, and they are on the far, far right.
Yeah. When we say they're sort of on the far right, who are they, would they be aligned with in Israel, right? I mean, it's the people who are kind of to the right of Netanyahu's government even?
Yeah. I mean, they have a complicated relationship with Netanyahu where they started this free newspaper in Israel, Israel Hayom, which is, sort of modeled on Fox in a way to be a political vehicle. And they really helped get Netanyahu elected, and they've helped him stay in office. But they've had both personal and political rifts with him. And so Israel Hayom is no longer known as Bibiton. It used to be just such a vehicle for him. So Netanyahu's nickname is Bibi. It was just this is his paper. So, yes, they are far right.
Yeah. Martina asked, in terms of mattering to U.S. voting, have any serious candidates for president ever been anything but a supporter of Israel? Doesn't seem like it's been a defining difference between mainstream candidates here. And it kind of goes to my earlier question, too. I mean, how different would the policy actually be, I think, is what people really want to know,
I think it would be different. I think a Biden administration would back a two-state solution. Like that, they have consistently done that. There's really no reason to think that that would change at all. Mm-hmm. And a Trump administration would not.
I think it's, what's difficult for people on the left to imagine who see what's happening as being so bad, as bad as it could get, is that it could, in fact, be worse.
Yes.
I think it's almost unimaginable, in part because there is no, as you've noted, in this vision, there is no future situation for Palestinians to flourish and have good lives.
Yes, there's no plan. So, yes, as bad as people on the left see Biden, Trump would be worse. They are not actually the same. My belief, and it's also just sort of if you listen to what they each say, Trump is security first, period. Yeah. And Biden wants peace.
We're talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine, about her new article, Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business. Adelson has committed $100 million to the upcoming election cycle in support of Donald Trump. We'd love to hear from you as you're listening into this discussion. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. The email is forum@kqed.org. One of the things that your feature really grapples with is the idea that Adelson herself, Miriam Adelson, sees herself as sort of supporting women in kind of a general sense. And you also note in the article, not Palestinian women in this war, but women in the region in general. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because it's one of those things that feels unresolved, I guess.
Yes, unresolved is one way to put it. Yeah, so, on International Women's Day, Miriam and her daughter did a panel discussion sort of like this in Israel. And during this discussion, Miriam was sort of forwarding the idea that Israel's dominance in the region would be good for the women in the region, that basically she's talking about there are women in burqas, there are women. She's like making all these arguments that yes, that there was some vision of women's solidarity. She wrote an editorial about this in the paper, too. And so it's a little hard to get behind from an intellectual point of view. But to me, it felt, as a reporter reading this stuff, like someone who was just going to grasp onto anything to try to forward her argument. This is what she wanted. And at the same time, she's a strong, smart, powerful woman. Right. Like, she is not a woman who was like sitting in the corner deferring to her husband. When Sheldon was alive, she didn't get nearly enough credit for how much power she had. They were a true partnership. All along the way, she was giving almost as much money as he was. She's going to end up
even though the press sometimes reported it, right, as just Sheldon.
Yes, and it was sort of wild to me as a reporter to go back and like look at how everything was reported and then go to like the FEC website, which like for if you're into that kind of stuff, it's sort of wild. You can just like in 2 minutes, you Google it, you can see what they've each given. And so there was both that kind of reporting and talking to people who knew them through their business life, through their philanthropy life. And everybody said to me, they did everything together. They made decisions together. So she has not lived a life of subservience as a woman at all. So I think she was sort of grasping onto that as like, well, maybe let's try this line of reasoning.
Yeah. Do you think that Sheldon dying in 2021, do you think that changed anything for her? Have you, like, as you talk to people in the course of reporting this story, did they say, well, now she's going to do X more than she did before, or Y?
You know, no, I didn't hear that from people. Over the past few years, she really dialed back her giving. Obviously, this, like, $100 million really changes course on that. But she dialed back her giving. And there were a lot of potential reasons for that. The pandemic was really not good for the casino business, as you can imagine. She was also really grieving. She was also sort of stepping into a new role. So I think it's possible to see her as somebody who sort of like took a step back to recalibrate. But I think there's no reason to think that she will like change course, because I think she was shaping their decisions all along.
Yeah. It makes a ton of sense. I mean, I think what is so fascinating about her background is just that she, at one point in your feature, says something like, I have a weakness for weak people. Like, she was like an addiction doc. Like, she was someone.
Right.
And were you ever able to kind of square that person with the person who, you know, is supporting this level of violence and war in that?
You know, I found that fascinating, and I thought about this question a lot, because not only was she an addiction doctor, you know, she also like didn't believe in decriminalization of drugs. Like, she has a very sort of complicated set of views. But like, as I said earlier, the way that I best understand it is that she was somebody who wanted to sort of protect and defend things that needed protection and defense. And in her earlier life, in like the first chapter of her adult life, she was doing that in a certain way. She was doing that through medicine. And she didn't just leave that behind. She kept working. She has addiction clinics. That part of her life is clearly very important to her. But to me, perhaps the coming together point is the desire to protect and defend and to try to sort of take care of the weak, to sort of, you know, I don't know, have a shell around vulnerabilities to try to get people to be stronger. I don't know. She doesn't really talk to the press, so she didn't talk to me for this story. And I really tried. I was like talking to her comms guy. I was like, will you get her to just answer this question for me of just like, tell me about her life as an addiction doctor. Tell me how this all fits together. But
no.
Nope.
Yeah. We're talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine, about her new article about Miriam Adelson and her massive donations to right-wing causes. Love to hear from you. Have you seen things change since Citizens United in this era of mega donors? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. The email is forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Coming up in the next hour, a forum with guest host Leslie McClurg, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie were as much a part of American culture as Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse, says Larry Tai, author of a new biography of the three men. Known worldwide for their pioneering compositions and arrangements, Armstrong's, Ellington's, and Basie's popularity among white audiences would ultimately lay the foundation for the civil rights movement. Tai's new book is The Jazz Men. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify, go to Apple Podcasts, and search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Liz Weil about Miriam Adelson, Republican mega donor. Let's bring in Michelle in Santa Rosa. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi. So I know this is probably a whole different kind of a show, this what I'm going to say, but I have to say I'm the executive director of a nonprofit that serves disabled infants and toddlers. Mm-hmm. And given the state of the budget, not just in California but across the U.S., this kind of donation is mind-boggling. I think, when I hear these things, I think I could run my agency without another dollar for 20 years mm-hmm. on that kind of a donation. So campaign reform, I mean, at what point do we start to talk about this yeah. in a serious way? And I say this as someone with an elected official in their family, so I'm not a novice and I'm not naive about why we, the American public, kind of want that, but I mean, mm-hmm. there has to be some kind yeah. of reform at some point.
Well, Michelle, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I mean, in local politics, what I saw, it was like $500 donations. You know, you see people giving like $250, $500. Like, that's actually what like city council people kind of
right.
live. You know, that's how they run their campaigns and stuff. And then you move to this scale, and it yeah. is just a totally other world. Thanks so much for that, Michelle.
Right. While I was reporting this piece, I had reached out to an organization called Justice Democrats that like supports a lot of progressives, just to sort of ask them what it was like to run candidates up against the kind of money that is coming in on the other side. And this comms guy I was talking to was just like, first of all, he was so world weary from yeah. having this job. But he was also saying to me, people don't understand these numbers that like, and he yeah. was talking about like $4 million given to some local campaign to primary a Democrat, to just like get out of the way somebody who wasn't going to have the, you know, the Israel policy they want. And he was just saying, people don't understand. Just as you were saying, these numbers are crazy. These numbers are not commensurate with anything else going on. They entirely change the playing field. And I think particularly when they come in on the local level, it's yeah. just like you're just blowing somebody out of the water.
Yeah. You know, one of the other fascinating parts of the story and the influence that Miriam Adelson has is that she's also been backing campus, I don't know exactly, campus institutions.
So she funds a yeah. group called Maccabee Task Force, which has yeah. been one of her primary philanthropic endeavors in recent years. So Maccabee Task Force basically supports students on campuses in what they call taking back the quad, trying to take back the conversation on campuses away from, you know, students for Justice in Palestine, like from the left-wing organizations and trying to get a stronger voice for the pro-Israel voices. So the Adelsons have given a ton of money to an organization called Birthright, mm-hmm. which
explain that a little
so
bit.
So Birthright is a gigantic organization that is incredibly effective at what they do. Basically, they do free trips to Israel for Jews in diaspora, Jews not living in Europe who haven't been to Israel before. I believe it's from 18 to 28 right now. So if you're a young adult, you can just sort of raise your hand and go on one of these trips, and you go to Israel for 10 days and you don't pay for a thing except your lunch. And there's been a lot of contention around this organization. They say they're not political, but of course there's a lot of feeling of like, look where your money is coming from. Mm-hmm. So Maccabee Task Force also does trips to Israel, not for Jewish students, for student leaders they identify on campus, people who they think will help, you know, with this Take Back the Quad mission, with sort of pushing back against the conversation on the left that has been a lot about what people call BDS, boycott, divest, sanction. And that's been a big deal, and it's been so this year in particular, it's just sort of crazy to see her influence both in these campus organizations and the election, of course. And we haven't talked about this yet, but she sold $2 billion worth of sand stock and became the majority owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah. In case you're listening out there and trying to figure out who you're going to root for in the finals, coming up on starting tomorrow. You know, let's bring in Robert in Richmond. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much. Well, my question has to do with the citizens. United decision that made corporations into a citizen. And in California, corporations have been prosecuted for elder abuse when they own facilities that ignore, excuse me, harm being done to some of the residents. And I wondered if that could be a technique used when people are hiding behind corporations to, you know, mask the fact that they're donating a lot more money than they should be, or maybe the money isn't being used correctly or being used as tax write-offs that shouldn't be, whatever. I just think it's not as impervious a shield as people think it is.
Huh.
If you make a corporation into a citizen, then when it breaks the law, it should be prosecuted.
Yeah.
As a citizen.
Kind of a...
Which makes the board of directors of that corporation individually, potentially, liable or at least susceptible.
Robert, I appreciate that. In part, you know, kind of a hopeful take there that there might be like a legal strategy to repair some of the excesses of Citizens United. I mean, this does seem, you know, like a broader, like your story really is making a broader argument, I think, too, about how our politics works and the role of this kind of mega wealth.
Yes. I mean, we all know, we all read all the time about how much money is in politics. And so she really is a case study. Mm-hmm. I was sort of at the beginning when I was reporting the story, I was thinking of her as like, okay, what happens when you take a person who has like a mission in life? You know, she's a child of the state of Israel. She wants to protect the state of Israel. Okay, fine. But what happens when you multiply that by $30 billion? Like, we all have things we're passionate about, and that's great. We all should have things we're passionate about, and we can all, like, debate them and fight them and try to protect our people, however you want to define that. But when one person has $30 billion, particularly when you can use that money to, in politics, the way Citizens United has allowed, it's really a very, very distorted world.
Well, and I think, we've kind of danced around it, but I mean, it is anti-democratic to the core.
To the core.
Right? I mean, that's kind of, as you sort of elegantly put it, this like divergence of political opinion and public policy, it's because the one vote, one person thing actually matters less.
Because if I can send out a million mailers like telling you candidate X, like, and the Israel lobby doesn't even campaign on Israel issues mostly. They know most voters are not thinking about Israel, but, you know, maybe the candidate who has a more liberal Israel policy also had like, you know, whatever, a DUI at some point. Mm. So let's like get that guy off anybody's radar. Mm. So it's really extremely anti-democratic, and I feel like it's easy to get despairing about how do we recover from this, given that the thing that the money allows is so much more influence when you have the dollars.
Yeah. You know, one listener, this is kind of an interesting question. You know, I'd be interested to find out how much overlap there is between these three constituencies that we've kind of noted, gun control, abortion rights, Palestinian peace. My instinct says the overlap is huge on guns and abortion, but the Israel-Palestine issue is more complicated and has people with all sorts of other issues crossing in and out from the otherwise right and otherwise left. How do you think about that? I mean, I just tracing it back to your previous point, this... Adelson clearly also has very complex.
Yeah, no, she's like been straight up like she's pro reproductive rights.
Right.
But they're just not the most important thing to her. And there's like a quote in the piece of her saying like basically, you can't have everything.
I'm on a mission, right? This is her mission.
That like, okay, you can't have everything you want in life. Something's going to have to get sacrificed. I'm willing to make this sacrifice.
Yeah. Let's bring in Amy in Oakland. Welcome, Amy.
Hi. I was just referencing a book that got brought to mind called Limitarianism, The Case Against Extreme Wealth by Ingrid Robbins. And it was referenced in an Atlantic article I read. And it was kind of a, like, lovely response to this whole discussion around how much is too much that people can amass in wealth when we have Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and all these people who have, you know, $125 million houses. It just doesn't make any sense. And a drop in the bucket is a $100 million donation. However way we want to take it out, it's bonkers how much money one person can amass. So I just wanted to reference that book because it's been really enlightening and interesting read in reference to this topic called Limitarianism.
Yeah. And if people want to explore that, I mean, it's basically one of a set of ethical theories about basically putting a cap on wealth, right?
Right. And exactly, thank you for...
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Anyway, I was just going to say thank you for calling attention to something that can give us all, like, hope and a path and at least a framework to think about change.
Well, if people want to look at it, too, it's from Astra Publishing House and quite interesting there. Where did you... here's a question that people have about Donald Trump. How does the same guy, Trump, have the support of white supremacists, Nazis in America, and Jewish Israeli nationalists, right? I mean, I think people really have a hard time making sense sometimes of this coalition.
Hard coalition to make sense of. I have a very hard time making sense of it myself. I think you have to see him as transactional. He is giving various constituencies what they want.
Yeah.
And at a certain level, I think you can see it's all like anti-progressive. It's not a vision of a world where every human being is wholly and fully equal.
You know, looking a little bit forward, I mean, the fortune is still vast. As Amy just said, $100 million is in fact still a drop in the bucket, so a tiny bit of the wealth that's available there. Based on this reporting, like in a post-October 7th world, like where do you think Adelson begins to push further?
I think she keeps working the playbook she's been working. So buying the Dallas Mavericks is like lovely and fun. And she has a son who owns a professional basketball team in Israel. But it is part of a much larger push to bring gambling to Texas. Mm-hmm. And bringing gambling to Texas is a way to keep making ever more money. Mm-hmm. And that money is all used for influence. So I less see her as somebody who wants to change course. She's been highly successful working the strategy that she's been working. So I see her continuing on. She's 78, but she is healthy and strong, and she is not going anywhere. That's sort of what I see happening.
Do you see any changes in the sort of cultural versus political donations? Like, you know, they're kind of working at different levels of society to kind of generate the same types of change that she wants to see?
Yes. So she's been giving more money to this Maccabee Task Force, which I referenced a moment ago about campus life. She's actually been giving less money to Birthright. So Birthright is, you could see it as like investing in diaspora Jews. Let's get Jews all over the world to have a strong connection with Israel and back Israel. So post October 7th, her rhetoric has been a little bit more of just like, if we don't have the support of the world, we're going to go it alone. And she doesn't really have the support of most diaspora Jews. Most diaspora Jews don't agree with her Israel policy. And so one hypothesis would be is that she's sort of giving up on that a little. And she's going to just invest more in the hardliners themselves as opposed to trying to get everybody in the Jewish community on board with her vision.
We're talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine, about her new article, Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business. We're going to try and get to a couple more calls and comments here. You know, one listener just says, to eradicate the corruption caused by Citizens United, all elected positions need to be publicly funded and remove private funding altogether. Trump has offered to sell our environment for $1 billion. Another listener asks, can your guest kindly expound on how women outside of Israel but in the Middle East have a better situation than in Israel? She dismisses the argument that Israel is good for women without any substance behind it.
Amhorn, I've dismissed the argument that Israel is good for... Can you repeat the question?
Yes. I think they wanted you to answer that, you know, isn't Israel good for women in Israel?
You know, I'm going to forget the acronym on this organization, too. But there's an international organization of, like, economic development, something like that, who did a recent study of how the rights of women and the situation for women in various developed countries has been progressing. And Israel came in last of 38 countries. So the far-right government in Israel is not good for women. There is a big pay gap. Like, so there are things you can point to and say, like, oh, that's great. Like, women have been in the military in Israel forever. You know,
right. In politics
and in politics, and there are ways, but also there's been regression, and it sort of it's a little bit of a compared to what argument. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think sort of holding up Israel as an icon of feminist progress is not really fair.
Mm. Let's try and squeeze in one more call here. Joe in Berkeley.
Yes. So my question is, and thank you for this attention to the Adelson donations. Since she's given so much money to these policies supporting the settlers, does she have a measure of success that she's going by? Has any journalist pressed her on how she's going to measure the success of these policies?
Yeah. I don't think she's sat down with a journalist for 12 years. Yeah. Well, let's ask that, Joe. Let's take it real quick just before we run out of time. I mean, one thing is we don't know exactly because she hasn't sat down with a journalist in, you know, almost 15 years. But what did you hear from people about what her metrics for success are? Thank you so much for that, Joe.
Well, I will say, well, she doesn't sit down with journalists. If listeners are interested, she somewhat regularly writes and publishes an essay in Israel Hayom, her newspaper in Israel, and it's also in English. So a lot of reporting about her comes from her own words and what she has said. So I feel like that would be the first place to point people to of what is her metric of success. She didn't sit down with me. She hasn't said, as we've talked about, nobody's got a concrete vision of what winning looks like here on either side. So I wish she had told me. I would like to know. I hope some other journalist goes out and keeps at it and figures it out.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think, though? What do you think she really wants, just as we wrap here?
You know... So it's very easy to say she wants security. And then there's the question of what does that mean? And so maybe that means the kind of stasis that Israel was at for a while in the Middle East. There hasn't been peace there. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe that's a vision of success, is that the state of Israel is seen as so strong by its neighbors and create so much fear that people give up and stop messing with it.
Mm-hmm. We have been talking with Liz Weil, features writer for New York Magazine. If you want to read the full article, it is a like rich and deep investigation. The article is called Miriam Adelson's Unfinished Business. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having this conversation.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with guest host Leslie McClurg.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Elaine Leung joins us now just ahead of the second hour.